Every year, thousands of people come down with the flu, but they might not realize just how serious it can be.
People are often surprised to learn that the flu is one of the number one killers in the United States.
That's journalist Tara Haley. Today on The 21st, we're getting you prepared for flu season with everything from decongestants to grandma's chicken soup. Plus, nuclear energy companies promised to do better after leaks and spills from their power plants raised concerns back in the mid-2000s. But the Better Government Association says those leaks are still happening. But first, you may know Rick Steves from watching him trek across Europe. But what you may not know is that he's an activist fighting to legalize marijuana.
In Europe, they've decided to take the crime out of the equation and treat marijuana like alcohol, for instance.
We speak with the veteran travel guide coming up. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned for The 21st. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Or should I say, bienvenido, willkommen, benvenuto? If you're travel expert Rick Steves, you've heard it all. Over the course of 50 books and 100 episodes of television, he's helped eager travelers get to, from, and across Europe. His company, Rick Steves Europe, also leads tours, provides audio guides, and produces its own radio show. What you may not know about Rick Steves is that he's also an activist. In his book, Travel as a Political Act, he writes about how travel can be a force for peace and understanding, and he's a vocal member of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. That cause brings him to Illinois this week. On Tuesday, Steves joined Democratic State Senator Heather Staines and Democratic State Representative Kelly Cassidy for a news conference to discuss why Illinois lawmakers should support regulating and taxing marijuana. He then testified before the General Assembly, and he's on the line with us now. Rick Steves, welcome to The 21st.
Nice to be with you, Brian.
There's so much to talk with you about, Rick, but I'd like to start with why you're here in Illinois. You're speaking out in support of regulating and taxing marijuana in the state, and why is this an important issue for you?
Well, I've been an advocate for changing our marijuana laws in the United States for about 15 or more years. I'm a member of board member of NORML, as you mentioned, and I think I bring a European sensibility to the discussion. I've spent a lot of time traveling in Europe with my work, and my European friends just marvel at how we're locking up pot smokers. Europeans remind me a society has to make a choice: tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And then they follow up with this annoying little comment that you Americans lock up 10 times as many people per capita as we do over here. Either you're an inherently more criminal people or there's something crazy about your laws. And I think we are tending to legislate morality and resort to incarceration more than pragmatic harm reduction, which would be a European approach to a persistent problem like drug abuse. I do want to stress at the beginning of this conversation, Brian, that I'm not pro-pot. I'm anti-prohibition against marijuana. And I was one of the funders and co-sponsors of the I-502 initiative in Washington State in 2012, where we actually were the first state, along with Colorado, to legalize, tax, and regulate the responsible adult use of marijuana, recreational use. For me, it's an opportunity to travel around the country, as I like to do, and share the track record we have in Washington State, just why we legalized, how we legalized, and what has happened since.
Sure. There are two bills at play here. There's Senate Bill 316, sponsored by Heather Staines, and House Bill 2353, sponsored by Kelly Cassidy. Can you tell us a little bit more about this legislation?
These bills at this point, the way I understand it, are sort of entry discussion points, and it lets them meet as we met today with a lot of concerned legislators and hammer out all the details. And essentially what Illinois is planning to do with Senator Staines and Representative Cassidy's leadership is to learn from other states that have legalized, and how can we deal with the black market of marijuana? How can we responsibly turn this black market into a highly regulated, highly taxed legal market? And basically, it's going to allow for a small amount of marijuana to be possessed and consumed by people who are over 21. It'll have all the safeguards that you can imagine to keep marijuana away from children. It'll respect the rights of employers to have whatever standards they want in their workplace. It'll have very strict provisions for maintaining safety on the roads and DOI concerns and so on. It'll most importantly, it'll learn from other states on how to have a smart law for this persistent problem.
Now, most of us, Rick, know you as the travel guy. Have you always been an activist?
I've always been a traveler. And the one thing great about traveling is you learn that people in other countries are dealing with the same problems as we are. And we can compare notes and learn from each other. And in Europe, they've got a problem with hard drugs. They've got a challenge with marijuana issues. And in Europe, they've decided to take the crime out of the equation and treat marijuana like alcohol, for instance. You know, it's a drug. It's not good for you. It can be abused. And we just have to realize that we can't wish it away. It's going to be there. We need to smartly regulate it. In Europe, there's a very serious problem with opioids and hard drug addiction like we have here in the United States. And the Europeans have realized that they can best deal with their opioid problem if they take the marijuana out of the issue. I do want to stress that Europe has found that there's no correlation between how much marijuana is consumed and how strict the laws are in a certain country. A lot of Americans think, and it seems reasonable to think, that there's a whole reservoir of decent people who would love to ruin their lives smoking pot if only it was legal. The fact is, as every society has learned, that's experimented with these different challenges and issues, people who want to smoke pot already do. And when you legalize it, use does not go up substantially. And that's a very important understanding. As a matter of fact, if you look at European statistics, the Dutch, who are famous for going easy on marijuana, in the Netherlands, you know, they haven't arrested a pot smoker for 25 or 30 years, and the joint's about as exciting as a can of beer. The Dutch smoke, by everybody's estimates, Dutch government statistics, EU statistics, and so on, the Dutch smoke less than the European average, and Europeans consume less per capita than Americans do. And you can do hard time for smoking pot in the United States. So again, when you decide to legalize the use of a soft drug, in the case of marijuana, statistics are in. Use does not go up. In fact, Brian, that's one thing I'm traveling from Seattle to Chicago to share is, in 2012, when we legalized marijuana in Washington State and in Colorado, we didn't really know what was going to happen. We had a hunch, judging from other people, other countries' experiences and so on, that things would be better. And now it's 4 or 5 years later, and we know the numbers are in. Of course, the statistics are not perfect, but essentially it's clear. Use has not gone up. Teen use, adolescent use has certainly not gone up. In fact, Colorado Department of Health statistics actually show that teen use has gone down in Colorado since they legalized marijuana. Road safety has not been affected. DUIs have not gone up. Crime has not gone up. What has gone up is tax revenue. And this is really a big deal. In Washington State, this year, according to our Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board paper, which was just published this last summer, in the last year, we have sold about $1.4 billion of marijuana legally, very highly taxed. We have generated $300 million of tax revenue in the last year for our state government. Half of that has gone into a health trust fund. $100 million has gone into a general fund, and about $40 million has gone earmarked for the prevention of drug abuse programs and education programs, so young people will be more likely not to get off on the wrong track when it comes to drug abuse. So it's a complicated issue, but there's no mystery right now that if you do legalize and legalize smartly, the world is not going to change in a bad way.
We're talking with Rick Steves on the 21st. And Rick, we can't have you here without asking at least some travel questions, of course. For people who have holiday and end of year trips planned to Europe, I'm curious what advice you might offer this year.
Well, thank you. I love talking about Europe. If you're thinking about traveling for a winter break, I would remind you there's all sorts of Christmas markets that are very, very popular. But frankly, if you've seen one or two of them, you've seen enough. And then I would just remind you that there's lots more in Europe to do in the off season. A beautiful thing about off-season travel is you don't have the heat and the crowds of summer. Europe is getting really hot and really crowded in the summer, and especially in the Mediterranean area, it's a great time to be traveling. So if you want to see the Christmas markets in Germany or Switzerland, that's a lot of fun. But I would also remind you that otherwise very crowded destinations in Italy and France are wide open in the winter. Remember to bundle up because it can be cold, and equip yourself with good information so you can enjoy a smart trip. But Europe has never been better organized to share all of its cultural wonders. And I just got back from 4 months of travel, making a bunch of new TV shows for WILL and the rest of the public television system. And I'm having more fun than ever enjoying Europe.
And Rick, if you've procrastinated, is it too late to book a trip?
Oh, you could go to Europe tomorrow if you wanted to. I mean, it's nice to plan in advance so you can have your choice of hotels and line up your tours and get admissions to some of the more crowded sites. If you're going in the summertime or the peak season, there's a lot of sites that you're smart to make reservations in advance. In the winter, it shouldn't be too much of a problem. A great thing about traveling in the winter, by the way, is you get much cheaper airfare. I would remind you, in peak season, and if you're going to crowded places, there's a lot of time spent in lines. And as far as I'm concerned, there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who don't wait in lines. One of my passions when I'm updating my guidebooks and researching around in Europe is if I see a line, I want to find a way for my travelers to get around it. There's almost always a way to get around it. And that just involves, planning in advance, making reservations for that site online. A lot of times you see a long line at the Colosseum or the Louvre or Versailles or something like that. Those lines are often lines not to get into that palace or that site, but lines to buy a ticket to get into that site. And there are lots of ways to get tickets without waiting in that line, in which case you walk right up to the turnstile and you go directly in.
And Rick, one of your specialties as well is recommending some off-the-beaten-path places. Any hidden gems that we should visit here in the next year or so before they become maybe a little too popular, a little too touristy?
Any secrets that I can let you in on? I think the fact is Europe is pretty well discovered, and you could find, when you go to Germany, everybody goes to Rotenburg and loves it, but it's very touristy, and everybody's looking for the untouristy Rotenburg. The fact is, Rotenburg's great, it's just touristy, and Venice is just great, but it's touristy, and Salzburg is great, but it's touristy. Go there, get a hotel right in the center of town, and be out early and be out late. Find ways to become a temporary local. These places are inundated with tour groups in the middle of the day, and they're doing all the cliches, they're seeing the slap dancing and yodeling on stage, and they're hanging out with other Americans back at their hotel. What you want to do is let your hotel be a springboard for really getting out there and becoming a temporary local. I think of myself as a cultural chameleon. When I'm in Salzburg, I'll have the local schnapps. I never drink schnapps here in the United States. When I'm in Greece after a long day of sightseeing, I feel like a nice glass of ouzo. I've never in my life in Seattle gone home and think I feel like a glass of ouzo. But when the sun's going down and you're on a Greek island, a glass of ouzo is very nice. When I'm in England, I feel like a spot of tea. Tea just makes no sense at all to me here. But in England, every day I want a spot of tea. Psychologically, I'm part of the scene. I'm celebrating the local style of life. And for me, that's a big help. There's a lot of ways that you can become just a smarter traveler. We Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world. We got to use our time smartly. We're always wishing our dollar was stretching farther. It's pretty strong right now, but you should figure about $1.15 or $1.20 per euro. That's a reasonable exchange rate these days. And the key for me that distinguishes somebody's travels is, how do you avoid the crowds? How do you become a temporary local? How many people do you meet? Not a lady in a dirndl who's going to sell you postcards, but how many real people that see you just as a friend instead of part of the economy are you going to connect with? And you can do that, but you just got to know the tricks for meeting people. If you go to a pub in England, if you sit at a table, you'll be all alone. If you sit at the bar, people know that you're there to talk and you'll have a new friend, and that's your entree into a much more intimate experience in that country.
Rick, something I've always wanted to ask you is why Europe, and will we ever see Rick Steves' African Safari on PBS?
Oh, that's a good question, Brian. I once wrote a book called Asia Through the Back Door. My favorite country is India, but I've really decided that I want Europe to be my beat because my mission in life is to inspire Americans to go beyond Orlando. I mean, it's just so exciting to get out there and get to know the world. We're 4% of the planet, and there's 96% of the planet out there waiting to get to know us. It's a lot of fun. It's filled with joy and beautiful people. And for me, Europe is the wading pool for world exploration. So what I want to do is, dedicate all my energy to doing guidebooks and tours and TV shows for Europe so Americans can go there, have a good trip, and then that'll be a springboard for adventures further afield. But I love Europe. It's a huge responsibility if I'm going to write a guidebook to Germany or France or Spain to do a good job on it. I've got 100 people that work with me in Seattle, and we are just having so much fun making TV shows, making our app, putting our tours together. A big part of my work is the tours that we lead around Europe. This year we took about 1,000 groups around Europe, about 25,000 people, and just had a lot of fun introducing people to all of our favorite slices of Europe. And my whole passion is inspiring and equipping people to go over there and have the trip of their lifetime. I'm still coming home with a longer list of things I want to see than when I left. It's just, you can never exhaust Europe of what it has to offer.
And before we let you go, you said you just got back from Europe, but have you planned out the next trip yet?
Well, you know, I do a lot of, I spend 4 months a year in Europe. I'm in April and May in the Mediterranean area. I go home in June and then July and August north of the Alps. It's just a smart way to travel to avoid the heat and the crowds in the middle of the summer. I spend about a third of my time working on my bus tours, and every year I take some of the tours that we lead around Europe. Every year I make some TV shows, and then I spend about a third of my time on my own with local guides updating the guidebooks. So this coming year, I've yet to decide what I'm going to be doing. This is sort of the season when I look ahead to the next year and figure out where I need to update guidebooks and what tours I want to work on and where I want to take the TV crew. But we've got a lot of fun travels coming up.
Very good. Rick Steves, longtime travel writer and TV host in the state of Illinois this week to discuss legalization and reform of marijuana laws in the state. Rick, thank you so much for spending some time with us today on the 21st.
It's my pleasure, Brian, and it's exciting to watch Illinois as it grapples with the very important issue of how to treat drug policy in this state. And I'm glad that they're paying attention to the success other states have had in taking a black market of marijuana and turning it into a highly regulated and highly taxed legal market. Thanks a lot, Brian, for your interest in that topic.
Thank you. Take care. Speaking of the holidays, tomorrow on the show, we're talking tech gifts. It seems like there's always something new, whether it's a smartphone, tablet, or some other gadget, and we'll help you make sense of it all. If you have questions, email us at talk@21stshow.org or leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. And as a reminder, you can always find past shows on the NPR One app on your smartphone. You can listen to the 21st and other great public radio programs. And if you have NPR One enabled on Alexa, you can find us by saying, "Ask NPR One to play the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. When you think about nuclear power, a lot of controversial images may come to mind. But nuclear plants have provided more than half of our state's total electricity generation since 2010, according to the Energy Information Administration. Nuclear power can be a clean and efficient alternative to fossil fuels, but there are risks, too, like the leaking of radioactive materials into nearby rivers, lakes, or streams. A recent investigation by the Better Government Association watchdog group found that since 2007, there have been dozens of accidental releases of water contaminated with radioactive material. The most recent spill was in May at Exelon's Braidwood plant southwest of Chicago. They had a leak of 35,000 gallons of radioactive material, enough to fill a backyard swimming pool. And this wasn't the first time that the Exelon Braidwood plant experienced leaks. Here's Will County State's Attorney James Glasgow and WTTW reporter Elizabeth Brackett in an almost decade-old NewsHour report.
It reminded me of a Homer Simpson episode that I saw where Homer worked at the local reactor and would put his jelly donut on the control panel. It's that bad.
What Jim Glasgow says is that bad is the way Exelon Corporation handled the leaking of at least 6 million gallons of water containing radioactive tritium from its Braidwood plant in Braceville, Illinois.
Exelon's Director of Nuclear Communications, David Tillman, will join us in just a few minutes. But first, Brett Chase and Madison Hopkins of the Better Government Association are on the line to tell us more about their reporting. Brett, Madison, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having
Thanks
us.
For having us.
Madison, let's start with you. Radioactive leaks and spills in Illinois are not new. In fact, they were bad enough a decade ago that Exelon reached a $1.2 million government settlement promising to guard against future accidents. Did you find that Exelon kept that promise?
Well, Exelon promised to improve plant practices of monitoring and reporting leaks of tritium. So that's a radioactive form of hydrogen and a byproduct of nuclear power that, if ingested at high levels, can lead to cancer. So from our reporting, we don't have a reason to necessarily believe that Exelon hasn't done that. But something we tried to point out through our reporting is that we don't really know. There's very little government oversight to ensure the public's getting the whole story with this. And right after the leaks happened, and that came to light in the mid-2000s, a new state law went into effect that requires Exelon to tell state officials whenever leaks happen. And the state officials are, in turn, supposed to do quarterly inspections at each plant to make sure they are getting the whole story. But we found that those inspections can be very limited, and there's very little oversight to ensure that Exelon is, in fact, reporting the whole story with each leak.
And Madison, how do these accidents actually occur in the first place?
They happen for a variety of different reasons. One of the more common ways that we've seen is through underground pipes or storage tanks. A lot of these plants are decades old, and some were built in the 60s, so there's been problems with pipes rusting and the leaks getting out that way. That's how several of the leaks that came to light a decade ago originated, and Exelon said it spent $100 million on upgrades to fix those issues. But they've also happened in other ways. We've even seen them just common human error. The one that happened at Braidwood that you just mentioned just a few months ago happened because a worker accidentally pumped water onto the ground as opposed to the river where it was supposed to be discharged. And that eventually got into groundwater and contaminated groundwater on plant site.
Brent, let's back up for just a second here. How many nuclear plants are there in Illinois, and where exactly are they in the state?
So there's six. Just south of Chicago, we have LaSalle, which is kind of close to Ottawa. We have Dresden, which is in Morris. There's the Braidwood plant, which was the center of all the controversy, you know, a decade ago, and that is in Will County. It's actually in Braceville. Then we have the Quad Cities plant, which was one of the two plants that Exelon had, said it was considering closing last year. Clinton was the other one, and that's in, you know, central Illinois.
Okay.
I think I got six there.
Yeah, I think so. How common are radioactive waste leaks and spills here?
Well, it's not like this happens every day or every month. I mean, we looked at 35 accidental releases over a 10-year period. You know, they have, you know, there's a variety of reasons why they happen. In some cases, we're not really, you know, certain what the source is, and neither is Exelon. There's a large category, actually, of they're called releases, and it's kind of a catch-all to say, you know, here was some tritium in a place that where it shouldn't be, and in some cases, we just don't know how that got there. I would like to explain, just so the listeners understand, that there is state permits that allows these plants to discharge some tritium into the rivers or, you know, whatever water, a body of water. And it's not uncommon, you know, for, you know, a manufacturing plant to get rid of its waste by putting a controlled amount of, you know, releasing a controlled amount of pollutants into the water. They're actually, you know, basically pollution permits, you know, that are given out by the EPA. What we're looking at is things where they weren't, they weren't part of the normal process.
Sure. And just a quick follow up there, Brett. Any idea how the EPA determines what's a safe level of tritium, for example?
Yeah, well, if you look at drinking water, and also we're not saying anywhere here that any drinking water was contaminated, but the drinking water is it's measured. A lot of people aren't going to, you know, be able to understand this, but it's picocuries per liter, and it's 20,000 picocuries per liter of water, which means when we reference high levels of tritium in some of these releases, we're using that base of 20,000. So if we say it's, you know, for instance, you know, 300 times that, that's what we're, that was the measurement of the tritium in the certain spills that we were looking at.
We're talking with Better Government Association investigators Brett Chase and Madison Hopkins, who recently reported on radioactive waste leaks as part of BGA's Special Power Struggle series. Brett, what regulations or penalties are in place to more or less make sure that nuclear power companies like Exelon are keeping their operations safe and hazard-free?
Sure. There are, you know, ways to penalize the companies for spills. The NRC has fining power, and the EPA, you know, for, you know, groundwater contamination, for instance, would be able to fine them. There's, you know, there was no instances of that, you know, in this case. The $1.2 million settlement that was actually reached in 2010 had to do with three plants, but Braidwood was sort of the most serious of 6 million gallons of, at least an estimated 6 million gallons of treated water that was leaking from the Braidwood plant and getting on private property.
Okay, so since 2007, 35 incidents, none leading to fines. Is that right?
Not one single fine. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Madison, back to you here for a moment. With some of the leaks and spills of radioactive material, we are talking about tens of thousands of gallons. Some of those lasting several weeks or even months before they're fully addressed. What's the risk for people living nearby?
Well, the risk with tritium in general is that, like we said earlier, if you ingest it at high levels, there's a concern that it could lead to increased risk of cancer or other health issues. But we're going to reiterate that Exelon, state officials, and federal officials have all said that none of these releases identified by us in the past 10 years have gotten into drinking water or gotten off-site in any way. So really what we're trying to point out with our reporting, though, is that how do we know that for sure? Where's the oversight to make sure that none of this did get off-site?
Very good. That's Better Government Association investigator Madison Hopkins and senior investigator Brett Chase. And we'll tweet out links to their reporting and share it on our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. I want to turn now to a representative from Exelon. David Tillman is the company's director of nuclear communications, and he joins us on the line from Baltimore. David, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the opportunity.
You bet. Certainly here we've heard about a number of spills and leaks, most recently in Braidwood. What has Exelon done and what is it currently doing to try to prevent leaks at its Illinois nuclear facilities?
Well, quite a bit. And if it's okay, I'd like to back up just a little bit and talk about the report that you and Brett and Madison just talked about, if I could. When Brett first contacted us and he was interested in doing this story, we were eager to have him out to the plant and to give him a tour and to let him meet executives and really just open up our books and our records and just talk to him on the record, off the record about our commitment to safety and environmental stewardship and just really kind of give him an understanding of tritium and what we do every day to keep our plants and our people safe. Unfortunately, early on we realized that Brett had a pretty narrow focus for his story, Brett and Madison, and it was really they were focused on a very specific data point, and that is these quote unquote leaks and spills that he just mentioned earlier. And it really what we saw is an inaccurate account of our environmental stewardship and the risk involved for our communities. They didn't use our statements in the story. They made some improper assumptions without proof. A couple of those that were along the lines of that the regulators are ineffective, and that's just not true. And then Exelon wasn't focused on the environment. That's just not true. Another assumption was that the local communities around our plants were somewhat powerless or uneducated about what we do. That is absolutely not true. And then lastly, Brian, there was the report kind of indicated a pattern of environmental abuse, and that's just these quote unquote leaks and spills that Brett and Madison referred to. The vast majority of these issues were not either leaks or spills. They were part of our commitment under the consent decree in the state of Illinois to lower the threshold at which we would report these issues, and to make sure that when we found tritium on our property, regardless of risk, the idea was that we would clean it up faster. We would raise our hand and notify our regulators and our stakeholders, and that we do a much better job of making sure that everyone's aware of what we're doing on the plant. So essentially the documents and the events that Brett and Madison refer to are our voluntary and required way of notifying a regulator every time we identify tritium on our property.
Sorry to interrupt here, David, but I guess let's back up just for a minute. And if you could, just let our listeners know how much nuclear power Illinois is using and maybe how that compares to other states.
Absolutely. Yeah. Illinois should be proud. It's a leader in clean energy and a leader in nuclear. Illinois is home to the most nuclear facilities. There are six in the state, and they produce about half of the state's energy, and they produce 90% of the state's carbon-free energy. So just an incredible economic and environmental value to the state. Illinois is one of the states that understood the power of nuclear and still does to this day. Illinois nuclear facilities offset more than 20 million metric tons of carbon pollution each year, right? Think about that. That's the value that these plants bring. They power 7 million homes, and they run, Brian, approximately 96% of the time. That's just an incredible reliability factor that these safe and reliable facilities bring to the state of Illinois.
All right. Well, David, thank you very much. That's David Tillman, Exelon's Director of Nuclear Communications. Thanks so much for joining us on the 21st today.
My pleasure, Brian.
Brett Chase and Madison Hopkins from Better Government Association are still on the line. Just want to go back to them for a second here before we wrap up this segment. You were listening to David just now. Madison, let's start with you. Anything there that you'd specifically like to respond to?
What I would like to respond to is the idea that some of these releases are perfectly allowed and permitted under different ways. We only targeted incidents that happened outside of the typical approved standard pathway to release tritium. As Brett mentioned earlier, that it is permitted by the EPA for every plant to release tritium through a specific pathway. And through our reporting, we made sure that we were only looking at ways that happened in a different way. And so specifically, yes, there are a few that are the typical ones you would think of as spills and leaks. And there's other ones that were classified only as releases, just sort of catch-all category when tritium showed up on a plant property where it wasn't supposed to. Experts we've talked to have explained that this means that there is some sort of problem on the plant. It can be big or small. It doesn't necessarily mean anything that is too serious, but it does mean that something happened that wasn't supposed to, and radioactive water was leaving the plant in a way it wasn't supposed to. So that's how we targeted that. And also with the history of environmental abuses, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it in that way, but what we were trying to explain more so with our reporting was looking at the government oversight of this. And Mr. Tillman explained that they do voluntarily and they make voluntary notifications to the state as well as required notifications to the state, and we're questioning who's making sure that all of those notifications are being made. How do we know that this leak that Exelon reported wasn't more severe, or that there was another one that didn't go unreported? We're questioning, how do we know that?
Very good. Brett, I also want to bring you back in here. The idea of older aging infrastructure here for just a second. You know, we've said that there are six nuclear power plants here in Illinois. Nationally, there are 61. How many of those are nearing the end of their expected lifespans?
Oh, more than half. And then within each plant you look at, there's a number of them have multiple reactors. So there's a total of 99 reactors. And almost, the majority of those, the vast majority, have been have received extended licenses, which means that they're planning to go beyond their originally expected lifespans of 40 years. The reason they're doing this is because, the industry feels like they can still make money doing that, although you probably know that the nuclear industry's had some headwinds, and we gave them the state of Illinois gave a pretty good bailout to Exelon last year. There was the threat to close two plants, one at the Quad Cities and the Clinton plant, unless the legislature and Governor Rauner, gave Exelon a bailout of about $2.4 billion. The problem is that it used to be Illinois was a utility monopoly, state-regulated energy market that was opened up to competition a number of years ago. The nuclear industry has found that competition is more difficult now, and especially with cheap natural gas and renewables, which actually do get subsidies as well. Renewables are like solar and more common here in the Midwest, the wind farms. So there are older plants. They're being they're expected to live past their originally anticipated lifespans, and aging equipment and older plants.
Okay, well, we'll have to wrap it up here. But Brett Chase and Madison Hopkins from the Better Government Association, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Great, thank you. Have a nice day.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Feel a little tickle in your throat or maybe a little sniffle in your nose? Like clockwork every year, cold and flu season hits and we're left dealing with the consequences, which can sometimes be deadly. Each year, thousands of people go to the hospital with the flu. According to the CDC, 56,000 Americans died during the particularly deadly 2013 to 2014 flu season. You may hear different things from different people about the best ways to nip your cold or flu in the bud. Whether it's putting Vicks on your feet or eating raw garlic, there are some unusual remedies to try. We're talking to one expert about some more traditional steps you can take to help prepare for cold and flu season. Tara Haley is a freelance health and science journalist based in Peoria, who recently wrote a piece about preparing for flu season for the New York Times. Tara joins us on the line now, and welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks very much.
Let's start here, Tara. How can people know if they're experiencing a cold or maybe something more serious like the flu?
Well, in the beginning stages, it's not going to be possible to know. They're just going to have the same kind of stuffy nose, sore throat, congestion that they might normally have. But if it's the flu, they're going to figure it out pretty quickly because the flu becomes much more serious much more quickly. It will involve a fever, aches and pains. Your whole body will just kind of feel like it's in the garbage and you just want to sleep and make all the pain go away. But the fever is the real tip off. You shouldn't be getting any kind of fever with a cold unless it's developing into something more serious like bronchitis or pneumonia. But the flu does have a fever, and the fever is usually the first indication that it's probably the flu. And that's a good time to decide whether you're going to stick it out at home or go see the doctor. And I would generally advise that people go to see the doctor if they suspect it's the flu because they were exposed or because they were running a fever with aches and pains.
And what are some things people can do if they're starting to feel those first signs of sickness?
Well, I do want to mention first that hopefully long before they feel that, they've gotten the flu shot, just because the flu shot not only can protect them against the strains that are circulating, but offers a little bit of protection against even past or new strains that are circulating because of the way it works. But once that's in the past and they're just starting to feel down, one thing they can do is start drinking lots of water and making sure that they're well hydrated. And that they are, you know, well fed in general, eat what you feel like you can eat. Some evidence suggests that zinc can shorten the length of a cold. There's not good evidence on the flu, but there is for colds that zinc supplements can be helpful. Wash your hands on a regular basis, just because one thing you want to make sure that you're doing is not infecting other people around you. And that's something you can also do for prevention. It's the second best thing you can do after the flu shot is washing your hands regularly. Make sure that you have on hand the medications and other items that you would want to have, such as fever reducers. If you're experiencing a fever, you'll want to have some acetaminophen or ibuprofen or aspirin around, remembering that aspirin should only be given to adults and not children. You'll want to have a decongestant if you're experiencing congestion, and any kind of cough suppressant and nasal decongestant are fine. There's not really big differences between them. You might want to have some saline drops for your nose, which is better to use than some of the ones like Afrin because it doesn't cause additional congestion later. It doesn't constrict your nasal passage. It just clears it out. Having cough drops on hand, if you like using them, is helpful if you're experiencing a cough. And keeping in mind that honey can also reduce coughing. And that works really nicely for children as long as they're over age one. You should never give honey to children under age one, but if they're older, giving them some honey can actually help reduce the cough a little bit. It might be easier for them and less of a choking hazard than cough drops. The big thing really, though, is rest. Having rest and lots of water are kind of the two big things that you can do. There's not any antibiotics you can take for a viral infection, so that's not going to help you very much. But getting rest means that your body's immune system gets to work and doesn't have to be distracted by other things that you're doing and can focus entirely on fighting the infection.
Tara, you mentioned, you know, that you recommend people get the flu shot. Is there still time for them to do that, or are we too late in the season already?
Not only are you not too late, if you get the flu, it's still not too late, which surprises people, because if you get the flu, you've only gotten one strain, and there's always several strains circulating at one time. So once you've recovered from that, it's still worth it to get a flu shot, because that will protect you against the other strains. The last thing you want is to get sick from the flu twice in one season, and it does happen.
I'm curious, what are some myths around the flu that you might like to dispel?
I think one of the big myths is that it's a mild infection that's no big deal. And I think that comes from two places. One is that people often confuse it with the quote-unquote stomach flu, which is actually a completely different viral illness called gastroenteritis. And it involves nausea and vomiting and diarrhea, which none of those typically happen with the flu. And while that is more mild, the flu itself can be much more serious and develop even into pneumonia and bronchitis. And people are often surprised to learn that the flu is one of the number one killers in the United States. Literally thousands of people die from the flu every single year in the United States. They usually die from the complications or from the pneumonia that develops, but it starts with the flu. So that's one of them. I think the other reason that people think it's mild is that the flu itself is really diverse. If you had the flu in the past and you contract a new strain that your body hasn't seen before but is similar to the last one you had, your infection is going to be milder. It's not going to be as serious. So it won't feel as intense as you heard other people describe. If you encounter a completely new strain, it could be a much more serious infection. So the fact that so many different people experience the flu in different ways, I think, is misleading and makes it sound as though, oh, it's not that bad for me. When even young, healthy adults and young, you know, and healthy children with no pre-existing conditions die every year. So I think those are the biggest misconceptions I hear, is that it's not that bad, when it usually is, and it's misleading.
Tara Haley is a freelance health and science journalist based in Peoria. She recently wrote a great piece about preparing for flu season for the New York Times. We'll tweet out the link to that piece for you to explore further. But Tara, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And as you heard, there's a lot that the medical community recommends to prevent sickness and help your body recover once you become sick. But what about what grandma recommends? Of course, we're talking about chicken soup, or maybe your grandma recommends pozole or egg drop soup. When it comes to home remedies, every family's got one. Chicago Tribune food and dining reporter Louisa Chu is no stranger to these delicious tonics, and she's with me on the line from Chicago. Louisa, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
I want to talk about chicken soup here in just a minute, because you recently wrote a great piece for the Trib about Chicago's lost Jewish deli culture. But first, I'm curious to hear some of the other soups and home remedies that you're aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, as someone who actually got the flu shot and had the flu recently, I just actually, and completely recovered, thank goodness, I find hot and sour soup to be a terrific remedy, not only for lunch, but also to sort of get that hydration, you know? I mean, I know you were talking about how just having fluids is so important. I think that really is a common thread with some of the soups here, not only the chicken soup, matzo ball soups, which we'll talk about a little bit more, but also noodle soups like pho, the Vietnamese noodle soup, which is usually a really rich bone-based broth, but also some of the tonic soups, which can be completely vegan. And there's actually a Illinois-based grower of Asian herbs who does terrific tonic herb packets. But also ginger tea. I know we, you know, you were just talking about how honey is not something that should be given to kids who are too young. But for me personally, boiling up some ginger slice with just sweetened with a little bit of local honey is really terrific for me too.
What is it you think about the hot and sour soup specifically that really tends to be a good comfort food in these situations?
Not only again the heat. But then in terms of the temperature, but as well as the piquancy, I mean, just having both of those really seems to be really terrific in terms of being comforting, as well as helping to clear out those sinuses a little bit.
Sure, and you mentioned the tonic soups. Mm-hmm. Those are something I'm not as familiar with. What are some good ones that you've tried?
I wouldn't necessarily say they're all good. this is one of those mom and grandma recipes that is really good for you. Can sometimes taste good too, but typically when I was growing up, my mom and my grandma would buy dried herbs from the grocery stores or herbal shops in Chinatown. And so a lot of those would have, some of them become more common now, like the dried goji berries or the wolf berries, mm-hmm. but also some other green herbs. I'm actually not quite sure what some of the ones that they use, but some of the herb packets that are used now can really be personalized according to, allegedly what ailments you have. You can go to herbalists either down in the Chinatown markets here in the Chicago area or some of the farmers markets around Illinois as well.
Of course, as we mentioned off the top, there is chicken soup, of course, with mm-hmm. noodles, with dumplings, or just broth. Mm-hmm. Every culture, every family has a different recipe. It sounds like, though, if it's matzo balls you're on the hunt for, it might not be as easy to find those as it used to be. You recently wrote about how there aren't as many Jewish delis in Chicago as there used to be. Why do you think this is?
Well, we actually answered a reader question who's asking about the dying Jewish delis in the Gold Coast area of Chicago. And there were a few different reasons that I heard when I was reporting out the story. And they typically were the high price of real estate in the cities, really the high food cost with scratch-made food, because typically a lot of these classic Jewish delis were all made from scratch. Now you will find, like, for example, a lot of matzo balls made from mixed packages, which are okay. They can be good, and even bouillon. But that scratch-made food cost, tends to be really high, as well as changing tastes and dying demographics. But the good thing is that we now have the rise of what they call themselves the newish deli, the new style Jewish deli. And so you might have, a really classic matzo ball soup, but then also you have some that are making, matzo ball soups with infusions of some other cultures as well. And so that's kind of a fascinating take on, what's happening with Jewish food culture here in this area, too.
Yeah, you went on the hunt for some of those, those newish delis. What are some mm-hmm. of your favorites in the city and maybe just outside?
Well, in the city, one of the restaurants, 11 City Diner, sort of bridges the gap between the older style and the newish style deli. They've been around now for almost 15 years. 11 City Diner in the South Loop of Chicago, they have a really terrific, huge scratch-made matzo ball soup with they always perch one perfect cube of carrots on top. And then also the bagel at Old Orchard Mall in Skokie is actually the older location. They also have a location in Lakeview. And those two are really terrific, kind of, bridging the gap right now between the older and newish. There is a new Jewish-style restaurant that just opened in Chicago called Steingold's, and they have a terrific, not only the soup, but also a sandwich, sort of, again, speaking of the newish style, they have what's called a sister-in-law sandwich, where instead of using a classic sauerkraut, they're using kimchi.
Mm. Very interesting. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. That's Louisa Chu from the Chicago Tribune and her own podcast, Chewing, helping us get our fill of chicken soup and other warming remedies during these cold winter months. Louisa, I think I feel better already. Thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. You can always find past episodes on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media, that's at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecelio, and Bob Holly. Libby Foster and Grace Stetson are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and thanks so much for listening.